The views and opinions expressed during this program are those of the host, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of Mid-America Radio Group, Indiana's Best Radio Management, employees, advertisers, or sponsors.
Good morning, Logan Sport. My name is Dave Packard. I'm in for this special presentation of Talk of the Town here on December 23rd. For the 12th time now, I believe, 1230 WSAL will air Roger's Christmas Story. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, this is Tom Castaldi with Mike Venable out on the Heritage Trail. Sometimes these stories on the markers recall our own memories, encouraged by the short days of an Indiana December. Every holiday year, I think back to 1944 and Roger's Christmas gift. As a kid, I remember those years because our country was in a great worldwide struggle to win a war for freedom. America had entered World War II, and everyone, old and young, seemed committed to work in ways to support the fighting soldiers on the front lines. Letters they sent back home gave a hint that they might be among the survivors of the battles that we overheard the grown-ups say they had read about in the newspaper. Even the messages in the letters from the bases around the world were vague because the censor's scissors had clipped portions of sentences that might be harmful to the security of the troops. Lives were sacrificed on the battlefield and personal sacrifices were made at home, but you never heard anyone complain. My dad, past the age limit, was never called to the armed services. As a neighborhood grocer and butcher in the 1940s, Dad's store was one of the many since a grocery could be found on just about every other corner in our northern Indiana town. Not very many people owned a car or could get gasoline to put in it, so they walked to the store. Materials were needed for the war effort, and goods for resale were hard to get. There seemed to be a shortage of everything: shoes, cars, gas, sugar, meats, and the like. Dad would take delivery of a side of beef on a somewhat regular schedule, and before it landed on the meat block, all the portions were sold. To be fair to his customers, he would save the choice cuts for his customers' names on the top of a list. At the next shipment, he reversed the order so the names at the bottom of the list got the best of the beef. In those days, local news moved by telephone, but much of what was communicated was passed along in the neighborhood grocery store. Crowds of shoppers would congregate to buy what would be on the table that evening. An oil burner stove stood near the middle of the store where the unhurried customers made it a place to stand, soaking in the warm radiating heat and discussing subjects lost on youthful ears. The evening newspaper carried news that fueled the imagination of the oil burner philosopher bunch, but to me, the best part of the entire paper was a small one-column, two-inch square that was never placed by the publisher on the same page 2 days running. You know the message, the one that works to test a kid's character and patience. On this day, it read, "Only 12 shopping days till Christmas." That was the day that my dad told us that the Christmas trees that had been delivered to his store were nearly all sold. Each morning, Dad carried the trees from behind the building and leaned them against the front store windows. At first, a line of trees stretched across the front and several yards around the side of the building, creating a very festive scene. My little friend Roger, from across the street and down the way a couple of houses, lived with his mom and sister. Roger's dad had gone off to war. The family had just enough money to pay the rent, keep fuel in the heater, and buy the essential foodstuffs that a family of three needed to survive. For some reason, Roger's dad did not have much money to send home. We didn't know the reason why. We wondered and prayed that people like Roger's dad would come home safely. The evening paperboy came along on his bike when it was dark outside. Now we were down to only 6 shopping days, and out front of the store, there was not a tree to be found. This year, they sold quickly. Earlier, the trees added that festive feeling to the neighborhood grocery, and now that they were all gone, it took a little something away from the season. Gradually, the days of December passed along until the newspaper's little box, this time with a jolly little elf's face, explained that we had only 2 days left to make our Christmas the best possible. It was about that time that our mom told us what she had heard in the store that day. My little friend Roger was not going to have much of a holiday this year. Mom always had a list of people she knew might be having trouble making ends meet. She would fill a bag with groceries to send over to Roger's mom because she knew that Roger's mom was not in a position to spend much, if anything, to prepare a proper Christmas dinner. For most of us, that holiday would be sharing some gifts, eating well, and enjoying the promises of the season. Not Roger. Even though little boy toys during those war years might be simple paper cutouts of small trucks and even smaller military soldiers, Roger wouldn't share like the rest of the neighborhood kids. His mom could not afford the extra expense of paper cutouts. Next day, with a chubby little Santa reminding us that the time had come, there was only one shopping day, and the word got to my father that Roger was not going to have a Christmas tree. All the trees out front of Dad's store were gone, and had been since there were only six shopping days. It was a time when people were resourceful, and my pop was no exception. Even though no tree was available, there were the boughs of trees left here and there where they had been on display for the time they had to survive their days of inventory. So what did Dad have us do but collect the branches, all that could be found? He then fastened them together with the wire from an old wooden crate. Adding a string of colorful lights, a little made-up tree appeared and was delivered to Roger's house along with a bag of groceries. As a tree, it wasn't much of a tree, but Roger's mom plugged in the lights, and it must have added cheer to their front room in those short midwinter days. From across the street, we could see the lights of Roger's little branch tree. I guess we were as proud of that tree as Roger must have been to have Christmas shine from his front room window. I was proud, too, of my dad, mom, and especially so that day. I just could not imagine my friend not having his own tree like the rest of us would be enjoying that year. On that Christmas Eve, from across the street, through a soft falling snow coming down, I took a long look at the lights on the branch tree. Squinting, the lights formed a shape. All I could see through the dark were the lights in the windows made by the colorful bulbs that seemed to form a star within the little branch tree, a perfect Christmas Eve star on a cold December night. The war ended the next year. Roger's dad came home carrying the emotional scars from a war that he had not asked for but marched away to just the same. Roger's family got back on its feet in time, and after we parted the old neighborhood, I never saw him again. If I do, I'll wish him a Merry Christmas, but how will I ever thank Roger for his gift to me? Whenever I think of past Christmases, I think of my little friend Roger and that tree made of discarded branches. I think of the people who made Christmas Day so meaningful to me and how during a world war in 1944, they gave a nearly perfect Christmas Eve gift. They gave a star of Christmas to Roger, and because of Roger, I received the spirit of Christmas. I'm Tom Castaldi, and we wish you a Merry Christmas from the Heritage Trail.
Hello, Logan Sport. Thank you for joining us on this conversation we're about to have. We just listened to Roger's Christmas story, the narrator of which is here. It's an actual true story. Tom Castaldi is here. I've said that correctly.
Yes, you did.
He's an Allen County historian, the Allen County historian. And we also have with us Thelma Conrad, executive director at the Cass County Historical Society. Thank you both for coming in and joining me today.
Good to be with you.
Thanks for having us.
Anytime. You know, Christmas is coming up, and first we'll start with you, Tom. We just listened to the story that you told. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came about?
Yes, I sure can. It started about 20 years ago, back in the early 1990s. Fort Wayne, which is my connection with Allen County, although I'm a native of Logansport, it was in the process of celebrating their 200th anniversary as a community. And one of the lasting legacies that come out of that was a trail, a very popular these days, as you know, which was going to be called the Heritage Trail, which is what it is called, and is modeled after Boston's Freedom Trail. So they put all these signs up, and somebody come along, one of the organizers, and said, you know, these signs that we put up, these markers, they're fine, but you know, it seems like they just get forgotten out there. And every once in a while, you go out and you'll see a number for a sign, or you'll see a sign that's all rusted over or something.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, I was doing some work with a public radio station, WBOI in Fort Wayne. It was WBNI in those days. And somebody had mentioned that we ought to do a history component for the station. And I said, yeah, we sure should. It kind of forgot. It just sort of slipped my mind. And you know, about 10 minutes later, I thought, oh my golly, we've got all this research completed on our own Heritage Trail. And it constituted about 52 markers around the downtown area of Fort Wayne. So we started to take those stories and record them as a series called On the Heritage Trail, and it continues to run to this day. Well, along the way, somebody said, hey, these stories are fine, you know, and all that, but the Christmas season's coming up. Do you have a Christmas story? And I thought, oh, gee, I don't. But in the back of my mind, I always had the story you just heard, and it was trying to change some names around to protect the innocent and all that stuff. But Pop was my dad, and Mom was my mom in that episode. And it happened back toward the end of World War II, and I just always remembered how that little Christmas tree was wired together out of branches, and how what a thrill it was for my little neighbor friend
it's Christmas. A great story. I'm glad we've been airing it, I think, for a long time now. You said that you had brought it in maybe originally when Andy Eubank was here as our general manager, right?
I think this is the 12th year that we've had this right before Christmas for WSAL to play. I was just so thrilled that both the station where it's recorded, that's fine with us, you know, and I just thought it was a fun thing to bring home.
Right.
And the thing of it is, it's timeless because it has all of the elements. Everything that Christmas is supposed to be is wrapped up in that story, so it never gets old. And it never goes out of style, and it makes me cry every year.
And probably several other of our listeners
cry as well, too. I'm sure they do.
And plus, one of my favorite things about a story is when it's true.
Yes,
you know, because
absolutely.
There's a lot of anecdotal stuff and you know, those kind of things out there, but a true story.
To your point, that originally was done in 8 minutes, which I believe this version is.
Yeah.
And Public Radio National, NIPR, come along and said, we want to reduce all of these pieces to 4 minutes. So I had to do that in 4 minutes. But you talk about, it's sometimes I can't get through the story.
When you're telling it,
you know. Dad of 16.
Right.
Brings back all those memories.
You got to get it down on a recording so you don't have to choke up every time.
Yeah, but it was just, it's hard to record it. But I'm so appreciative that that WSAL airs it. Thank you very much for doing that.
You're very welcome. It's I love that kind of local content.
We're discussing that very subject, it's about history. I think the more you know about your background as a community, the more pride that you can take in your community. And that's what builds community, is pride. I think that's what kind of keeps my interest up in the local history anyway. Get a little lost in world history.
Yeah.
Should have studied a little harder when I was in school. But
too big a subject. Too broad. Too broad.
Well, it's global. It's so big.
Yeah.
So Tom had brought in, you had told me that both you and Thelma had contributed to a Indiana Bicentennial book titled Undeniably Indiana. I'm looking at it right now.
He's got
a copy of it. It's a beautiful cover.
I'll hold it up to the...
You guys, to be part of that book, I mean, that is a beautiful book. It's got the sky and it's got a cool image kind of around it. It's a nice little thick paperback, really.
274 pages.
274 pages.
Although, you didn't write that many pages, did you, Thelma?
I know, I certainly did not.
Each story is about someplace in Indiana, and it's just it just reeks with Hoosierism, if you will. Here, basketball, I just went to a page here, the 50 greatest nicknames in Hoosier hardwood history. That's just a story that's in
and
there.
And when did that come out?
Oh, my goodness, last month, November?
Yeah, kind of recent,
Is this your first publication, Thelma, like of something of this
in
sort?
In something of that sort, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
because that just looks like a book that you'd buy, anywhere just on the shelf.
Yeah, and I think you can get that through the Indiana Historical Society. And is there another place?
Yeah, the IU Press.
IU Press, of course. That's
who publishes it.
Yes,
it?
Yeah. Yes. IU Press. Yeah. Yes. Well,
so I was just going to say, since we're talking about Christmas, let's first start about the story contributed. I've got a picture here that has to do with electrifying Christmas. Tom, can you tell me a little bit about what exactly that is all about?
Yeah, I thought that part of the story of this Rogers Christmas story was when it was first started was, did I have a Christmas story? And nothing surfaced, except I had that in the back of my mind. And so over the years, other stories then started to formulate. And one of them is back in 1937, there's a department store, or once was, in Fort Wayne that decided that they would, as a merchandising gimmick, I suppose, decorate their windows. That was very popular back in the 40s and the 50s, and I suppose still do. You go to Chicago, or you could go to any of the big department stores, any large stores, and they'd have windows all decorated with little animated creatures doing Christmassy things. And somebody came up with the idea of making an image of Santa Claus with a reindeer. And this thing is like two stories high that was mounted on the side of Wolf and Dessauer's department store and constitutes something like 24,000 light bulbs. So every year...
I wonder if they set that up and there's just one out and they got to, you know, find the replacements.
And if they do, you can really tell when one goes out, I can tell you. What happened was this thing got put in a warehouse for years and years, and there was a couple of people that got busy and decided that it would be appropriate to refurbish it and put it on the side of a bank building. And oh my goodness, they've been doing that for maybe the last 10 or 15, maybe 20 years. But there was this long hiatus where nothing, I mean, it was just stored away. And employees and some, I forget which union it was, but it was one of the electrical union folks that got the idea, hey, why don't we volunteer and we'll fix that and we'll make it work again. And they did, and they hang it up. And that's what kicks off the Christmas season up the northeast of here, up in Fort Wayne. And from there, you can walk around and see other interesting events. For example, if you walk two or three blocks from here to the Allen County Fort Wayne Historical Society, they have a gingerbread festival, some couple of hundred gingerbreads that people make. And it just really makes a wonderful, especially for kids.
You know, I get excited, you know, 2 weeks ago or whatever when they put up little Christmas trees all around town with lights and stuff.
Oh,
but
yes.
A huge, you know, 20,000 light structure. I mean, I wish Logan Sport had like this weird thing that they erected, like, or not weird, but something abnormal for the season, for the year. You know, like a huge train that had Santa Claus on it from like the Iron Horse days that, like, you know, painted the entire side of a building.
But we do have a little Turtle Waterway where we can, you know, set up our lights, and that makes it beautiful. And really, the downtown.
Are they doing that this year?
I haven't been by there recently, but I know they have lights on the trees and things, but you know, it is nice in recent years how Logan Sport is, you know, the light poles, everything is decorated, the bridges are beautiful, and so we do electrify Christmas.
And I was just going to say that I came through town a week or two ago, and it was kind of breathtaking. It's a little over the top, I don't know, but the bridges, I mean, we got these two rivers coming to town, and most communities would die for that, you know? And you go, and it just looks so wonderful when you come in across
it does.
The bridges.
It is.
And the flowers, the rest of the season. Oh, my gosh.
I just moved here, you know, back here. You know, I'm from here. I feel like, you know, you almost never left when you take the big body of work, and you're like, well, I was gone for 5 years, but... You know, I'm almost 40, so. The flowers, I was going to say. You know, you get on Facebook even before I moved here and stuff, and people were just like, these flowers that people, you know, the city has put out. They were the purple or pink, but they were just all over. Yeah. And stuff like that, I think, just makes the city, you know, just so much greater of a place to visit and see. And we have all the walking trails, and we have all these things that just are kind of scenic and beautiful that, you know, we keep kind of beautifying Logan Sport, and, you know, that can only
be better things. And that's so important. I mean, it's really enjoyable to come through and see all of that going on.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, they mentioned the trail over on the north of the Eel River and going for, where is it? It goes
the
from 6th Street.
The River Bluff Trail. From 6th up to...
out to Davis Street
Davis
Road.
Davis Street, yes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I just think that's pretty wonderful. And that may be our way to bring up a trail that Delma and I have been talking about and working with Mike, our county historian.
Yes, and that'll be finished up pretty soon. We just ordered the last set of signs, and that's the Wabash and Erie Canal towpath.
Yes. What's towpath mean?
Well, because...
I wouldn't know.
Of course, we're sitting here with the foremost authority on the canal, but I do know this much. I do know, if nothing else, from going to the interpretive center over next door to our neighbors, but the canal boats were on the water, and then they were pulled by mules, ropes attached to the boats pulled by the mules. So you've got the boat in the water, and you've got the mules walking on the towpath.
On the towpath,
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
And is that like engines off? You're approaching a place where you need to, why are they getting towed? They weren't getting towed
getting
all the way down the river.
Well, they're getting towed because they don't have any other motive power. I mean, they were just boats like a bar of soap, like ivory soap in your bathtub, just sitting there, see?
Oh, yeah.
So they had to hook it onto something.
So no motors back then.
No motors. They had steamboats that, you know, I think on the Hudson River or something that's coming along. But and you, obviously, you couldn't put a sail up on a canal boat to make it go because you were going down a defined channel.
Yeah.
So what they did is they dug a channel in Indiana. Well, actually started in it started in Fort Wayne because that's the highest point of this canal, and it came this direction toward Logansport, got over near Delphi, crossed the Wabash River, went on down to Terre Haute, and then because of financial problems back in 1837, it went over and connected up with what was going to be the Central Canal. You see remnants of the Central Canal in Indianapolis, but they didn't complete that. They put the Wabash Erie Canal into that point, took it on down to Evansville to get into the Ohio River. Now, on the other side of Fort Wayne, they went in and went over to Toledo. So now you had a waterway that would take you from the Great Lakes, that is Erie Canal, Lake Erie, excuse me, and it would take you to the Ohio River. And that followed an old French explored portage. There's a high point at around just this side of Fort Wayne that otherwise you could take a boat from Fort Wayne to here, and you almost can in high water areas. So they dug a trench 40 feet wide, 26 feet across the bottom, 4 feet deep, and they all this is spec'd. See, I mean, that's an engineering term for specification. But so they had a path on one side that was raised a little bit. It was 10 feet across and paved with gravel. And then there was another one on the other side called the berm bank, and that was up. So that would keep the water in place. One of the engineers, superintendent, had a slogan that said, the art of building canals was not so much of keeping water in canals, but to keep the water out of it. Because if you notice, it sort of, well, if you were to look at a map, it follows pretty much the Wabash River all the way down to the Terre Haute. So that's a little more than you wanted to know, I know, but...
No, that's great.
Yeah, that's why we have historians on the radio. I mean, you have more information than, you know, we might normally ask. Or.
Well, and that's the thing, because it's really hard for people to understand that water went through Logansport. I mean, Erie Avenue was not a street. It was water. That was the canal. And Fifth Street was not a street. It was water. That was the canal.
And the Erie Avenue is the only story I remember from, like, local history and when I went to high school or middle school.
You couldn't follow
the whole
path.
You can kind of connect that. Yeah. Okay, the Erie Canal, everybody's heard of.
At least you knew that.
Erie Avenue. So I find that fascinating.
But these signs that we came up with, I mean, it's not that we came up with them, but rather it's a continuance. Some of our neighboring counties through which the canal flowed have marked that trail so that people that are interested in their local history and in canal history can kind of follow that. You can drive along and follow that path and follow the signage. And
is there like an originating sign? Like, can you park in a parking lot and you're like, you are at the beginning of this, and then like get in your car and do like a, you know, start driving?
Yeah,
like,
literally in Fort Wayne there.
It'd be cool if there was a starting point.
Yeah. Well, what happens, Dave, is that the whole vision of this thing was just to have a trail, not one that you'd necessarily walk on, but one you could follow on your bicycle, your motorcycle, your car, your bus, something like that.
Right.
And obviously you can't get on it. but we've designed it so it's as close as you can be to it. So when you come, so the beginning, when you come out of Miami County, you're on the Lewisburg Road, which is the old original road between Logansport and Peru. Mm-hmm. And before 1924, they put Highway 24 in over to Peru. And so now it's moved. However, so the first sign perhaps would be almost on a county line. You wouldn't really need a parking space because you're going to stay in your car. You need your car to get to the over to Carroll County.
Right.
So you'd follow all along, go through Lewisburg, and then you got to get back up on the Heartland Corridor, I think.
Yes.
We do, don't we?
Yes.
Thelma? And then, so now you're way off the canal per se, then you got to get back over to, what do we do? We went down to Pottawatomie Point, I think.
Yes, we did.
See, and that puts you on 18th Street where the railroad, I don't know what you call it, the Transcoat's located.
Railway, yes, it's right there.
Then you'll be
in. Is that in town here?
Yeah, on 18th Street, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you know where the railroad tracks.
I call it Tidmouth Sheds to my son because that's where Thomas has all his trains.
There you go.
So
oh,
okay. It's like the Logansport.
Same thing.
So the canal then would come down Erie Avenue, named for the Wabash Erie Canal.
Yeah.
The Erie Canal was in New York, and it was completed in 1825. That's the canal we're talking about. It didn't get started until 1832 when they broke ground by the first mayor of Logansport.
My relative, Jordan Vigas.
He's
my great-great-great-great-grandpa.
Oh, my gosh. May I have your autograph
and
your
family? Yeah. And now look what we've become in that line.
But, I mean, these are...
We've come all the way down in one of those caveman drawings.
I would imagine you're very good with a shovel because he's the guy that broke ground for this longest canal in the Western Hemisphere when it was done, 468 miles. That's quite an accomplishment for great-great-grandpa, I'm telling you.
Yeah. There's a great picture of him in the mayor's office. I was interviewing the mayor once in the last couple of months, and he has a nice picture of my grandpa.
You look
and brings
just
it,
like him.
Brings it, yeah,
it's
just
amazing.
Without the the sinister goatee or whatever. You can't see me, but I'm kind of stroking my mustache, trying to curl it an old-timey.
So the canal came down to Fifth Street, which was the landing. That was what they called them. I always thought that was interesting. Land airplanes. Darned if airports don't call them terminals. What? Terminal has kind of got an ominous sound to it. But then when you get across the Eel River, then you still see the abutments of the aqueduct out in the Eel River. That's right at the end of Fifth Street. It used to be...
Fifth Street.
Yeah, it's where the K.G. Schmidt Brewery
behind
was.
The old brewery building, which now is belongs to the Graybill family. And there's a style salon there and a crafting store. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's all occupied now. And of course, that's water going across water. Are you getting that, David?
Water going across water?
Yes, because you have an aqueduct going across the Eel River. So when they're pulling that boat, Fifth Street is water.
Yeah.
You get to the south bank of the Eel River, and now they're pulling the boat over an aqueduct, over the river.
Okay.
And to continue on out of town.
So it's just kind of a bridge, a water bridge?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Like a water overpass?
Yes, exactly.
And keep in mind, it's all level because water, finds it. And then it was a big turnaround basin where boats could turn around on the other side, on the north side, which is all filled with houses. And then it starts out. Guess what the name of the street is that it goes out? It's called Water Street.
Where the Pepsi plant is.
Interesting. Yes. No, that's cool. I was like, Exit Street?
Water Street.
And a word on that aqueduct, since we're in the Christmas season and it's really cold outside and everything, I can remember reading about how ice skaters on the Eel River, that aqueduct was leaky. It would leak water on the skaters, and it was kind of slop over.
Hair got all frozen, like when you go out
What always intrigues me is that the ice skating on the Eel River, we can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. It doesn't freeze up like it did back then. Mm-hmm. But anyway, aqueduct could be leaky.
But David, I must interject here because we just mentioned the aqueduct. If the water in the river was freezing, the water in the canal was freezing, which is one of the reasons railroads came along when the technology improved enough, and they took over the business of the canals. That's one of the reasons.
They could also 365 days a year instead instead of
medium. And there's all kinds of minutia we could get into on how that all worked out. But then the canal went out through Fitz's Glen, and then and this is how we hope to I think the signs all go out that way as well. I mean, you can roughly follow what we just talked about by following these signs in your automobile.
Okay.
That's what this is.
And it's gone. I mean, we've kind of gone all the way from Fort Wayne to these signs aren't in yet, but this is what we're trying to do.
Some places they are.
Okay. Yeah. So we're trying to get the rest of the signs in, but you could go from Fort Wayne. We've come through Logansport, and is that where it ends?
No. Carroll County has all of their signs in place.
Okay. And it would continue on, hopefully.
It's slow. It takes the local community to want to put them in.
And it does. That's where I should interject that it's because of your local historical society, your local county historian, Mike Stadahar, and working with a Logansport native who happens to be Allen County historian. It took all of those people to get together and say, hey, this is something we need to do. This is a worthwhile project. People, they do want to know. And
It's just great stuff that doesn't get much publicity. I mean, history sometimes just gets forgotten or brushed away, if not for you guys who, bring it back to life.
Well, that's why we're here on the radio.
Everybody's probably said this is listening. If I hit the Powerball or whatever, which everybody says without playing usually and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But I would donate to your historical society. Mm-hmm. I mean, you guys are doing work to preserve, some of that just rich history that kind of gets buried with time, over the years. I wanted to ask before we move on, and I'm not sure which one of you would like to answer it, but I was talking to Tom earlier, and I said Erie Canal. And you corrected me to say Erie Wabash.
No, Wabash Erie.
Wabash Erie Canal. Yeah. So the Erie Canal that you hear in all history books, did that come through here?
No, that stopped at Buffalo in Lake Erie. The canal.
Okay.
See, there's more than one of these around the United States, mostly in the eastern part of the states, but typically they name them from whence they come to whence they go. In other words, this one starts in Erie, Lake Erie, as it were, dumps out into Lake Erie, and it goes to the Ohio River because of the Wabash River, so it got the name Wabash Erie. And DeWitt Clinton, who was the father of the Erie Canal at the grand opening, couldn't be there, but he sent a letter to your great-great-great-grandpa and said, you have found a way to get my canal into the Ohio River, to some words of that effect.
Okay, so it did connect to the original Erie Canal.
Because the Erie Canal came in from the east side of Lake Erie, and the Wabash Erie come out of the west side of Lake Erie.
Good,
so you
good.
Had to
so
take a steamboat across there if you were a traveler.
Okay.
And if you get to Ohio, they like to call it the Miami Wabash Erie because they brought the Miami Erie Canal up from Dayton area, and their legislature decided they're going to change it. But it's really the Wabash Erie.
Well, I thought that was an important point to bring
Bingo.
Up because I'm like the every guy dope that would say, oh, Erie Canal right through here, when it's really technically the Wabash Erie, or you don't want to make your local historian mad because they can really get crazy if they're mad.
Well, it is what it is, though. And you brought
you
up a very good point. That's good.
It's like mispronouncing somebody's name over and over. Can't you get, that's not what. I wanted to ask Thelma, before we get too far away from this book, because this book just looks really interesting. I haven't read any of it, but I mean, it's so pretty of a book, and you guys have both contributed to it. Thelma, what did you add for the book, or how you reapproached? Do you have any funny story about, this is one of your first
publications? Oh, it'll be funny. Not because it is funny, but
you won a contest.
It's a Christmas time. It's not a Christmas story. But, the thing of it is, I submitted a couple different stories to this this compilation, and the one that they chose happened to be one that I titled The Dark Side of a City, and it's about prostitution.
Here.
In Logansport, how it got started in the 1800s and with the railroads, and then how it finally was eradicated in the 1980s by the first woman mayor. Joan Wilson.
The first woman mayor in Logansport?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes, Joan Wilson.
What year was that?
In the 1980s, and I'm sorry, okay. I forget the exact year.
Did you say 1980s?
1980s, yes, sir.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes, sir.
Oh, my
gosh. You can look that up when you're at the library or read the book. But as I say, since this is a Christmas time show, we're talking, but let me add my Christmas thing, though, because in talking about that, I ran into a very, very elderly lady who told me that when she was a little girl, she lived kind of close to the neighborhood where these businesses were famous for being located. And her story was kind of a good thing, because she didn't know what kind of business that was. She did notice.
She's just a little girl.
Yes.
Right?
She did always take note that those women seemed to be awfully dressed up and awfully made up and this and that. But every year without fail, they would, when she was little, they would present her with a lovely Christmas gift. She'd get like a big doll, you know, something that kind of like the perfect gift for a little girl, and her family really didn't have that much money. So those gifts, each year she looked forward to whatever those ladies would stop by the house and give to her.
Well, that's very sweet.
So there's the Christmas, the Christmas happy part.
Very neighborly.
The neighborhood.
Gals. I love it.
But that's the story, and I couldn't, you know, I tried other subjects, but that's the one they were interested in.
Yeah.
But it is a history, you know, and it
In some small way, at least, if not any more, contributed to the culture of the railroad people that were here and the travelers, and why some people may have stayed, and you know, and then their ancestors became the people running the you know. So
it is an interesting story. Yeah. It is
true.
And you would not believe how many ladies groups ask me to give that presentation.
So any ladies groups out there, or men's groups, if you want Thelma to tell you the story, I mean, she's bookable for parties. And
if you look at it, if you think about it, in Gone with the Wind, like during the Civil War, if you think about it in the way it was in the movies then, you can kind of understand it. Because Gone with the Wind is one of my favorite movies. And in that movie, Rhett Butler takes his friends to Belle Watley's house and saves their lives in doing so. And when he brings them back to the respectable ladies' homes and their wives' homes, one of the first things the doctor's wife asks him in the movie is, "Were you really there? Do they really have red curtains and mirrors everywhere?" So, you know, it's like you don't want to discuss it, but you do kind of want to know.
Right. Yeah. And it's amazing that we have so much, you know, information on that kind of stuff, along with all the rest of history in town, like where we were at, and there's some structures still up and that kind of thing, right? Still,
it's like
there.
It's like anything else. If you dig, if you're curious about something and then you start digging, you would be amazed how much you can find on a subject. Don't you agree, Tom?
Yes. But it's that, you know, and that's the thrill of it all, is the digging
it
in.
Is.
And
it is.
It's like I had a friend come in, his wife came into my office one time, and she was so excited. She was into genealogy, and she says, "Oh, I got to tell you. I was doing my husband or my wife. I'm looking at my genealogy. So just a babbling away. And I said, what is it?" She says, "We found a pirate."
Yeah, that's.
I watch those Ancestry.com commercials like, you know, the average man might. And I'm like, you know, it's not that easy. I'm not going to give these people $25 or whatever to start out, and then I'm going to click on a leaf, and all of a sudden my relatives are going to pop out and start giving me high fives on FaceTime. You know, it seems like it's still going to be tough work to do that. So it's great, you know, that we have historians to dig up stuff for you, or, you know.
We'll pause right here. Thank you so much for joining us for this conversation with Tom and Thelma. We'll be back shortly with the end of our interview.